The views expressed on this show by guests and the host on issues outside of the 9/11 controlled demolition evidence are the opinions of those individuals alone and do not necessarily reflect those of architects and engineers for 9/11 truth.
Welcome to 9/11 Freefall. I'm the host, Andy Steele. Today we're joined by William Veal. He was a chief assistant public defender in Contra Costa County, California, supervising the first alternate defender office in the country to handle felony cases. After his retirement, he was part of a team that represented Pentagon worker April Gallup in a lawsuit against Bush administration officials, alleging that they purposely allowed the attack on the Pentagon to happen. We'll hear more about it from his own mouth in just a few minutes, but he's got a book out now called 9/11, The Awful Truth. We'll be talking about that book today as well. Mr. Veal, thank you so much for coming on 9/11 Freefall today.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
And it's been a long time the show's been on the air, and I have yet to have you on the show and hear your story. And you're somebody that has gone to bat for 9/11 truth, but we'll get into all of that. I like to start from square one. And in doing that, I'm going to ask you, please tell us more about your career as a public defender. What was that like for all those years?
Well, being a public defender is a very interesting and a very difficult job. With great highs and terrible lows. I basically was a trial lawyer, criminal trial lawyer, and I represented people who couldn't afford their own lawyer to be hired privately. And I did every kind of state case that you can do. I spent most of my last 15, 20 years doing death penalty work. And I tried a number of death penalty cases. So I spent a lot of my time in court, and you learn how to deal with evidence in situations like that. And I just would have retired comfortably and quietly. But a friend of mine threw a copy of David Ray Griffin's book, New Pearl Harbor, across the desk at me when I went in to talk about something else in the office one day. And my life has not been the same since.
No, absolutely not. This is the case with so many of us when we first wake up to this issue. It is something that turns your whole worldview on its head, and at first there's confusion. At least for the people who woke up and did something about it, there was initial confusion. Some people just turn their brains off and refuse to look at it, and they go off in another direction. But there is confusion, and then you get a new understanding of the world. I mean, how much did your worldview shift after learning some of the truths about that day? I mean, were you open to this kind of knowledge beforehand, or was this something that was completely out of left field for you?
Yeah, fair question. I think broadly, I mean, I've just done a fair study of history, and was certainly aware of the Tonkin Gulf situation. I don't think I would have been able to point to Mukden, for example. I knew about the Reichstag fire. So the idea of false flag was kind of in background. I'd read some things about it. But when the notion first occurred to me of an inside job with regard to 9/11, I was actually driving in San Francisco, and I came across an inside job rally. And I just said to myself, what in the world, you know? And I came back, and I banged around the computer a bit, and I saw a notion that no plane had hit the Pentagon. And I laughed out loud. There was nobody else in the room. I laughed out loud. And I turned the thing off, and I said, come on. So in some ways, I was one of the best possible people to have to have this business directed at me, because I was so completely looking in the other direction, if you would. Then when the guy, my friend, showed me that book, I read the book, and I read the entire book, and then I read, 30 more and all kinds of documents and scholarly papers and things like that since. So, in a way, I was open to it, but in a very serious way, I wasn't, because I laughed at it when I first heard about it.
Yeah, same thing with me. I didn't get offended. I just dismissed it. Now, let's talk about April Gallup. For people who are not familiar with her case, we may have newcomers to the movement in the last year who are just catching up to this entire story of 9/11 truth. Please tell them about it. Tell them who April Gallup was, how you got involved with her case, and what were the grounds for the original lawsuit?
Okay, well, April was a distinguished soldier who worked at the Pentagon, which is an honor in itself. And so she was in the building at the time that whatever happened there happened there. And she was there with her little son, who was just 3 or 4 months old at that time. And she managed to get out of the building and collapse on the ground outside. And as the weeks and months went by, she learned what she said. They told her what had happened. There's some airliner had flown into the building, and nothing in her memory could square with that. And so she thought that there was a problem. So she became active in the sense of going to the various hearings and things like that. And she saw Donald Rumsfeld testifying before the 9/11 commission, and she didn't believe what he was saying, and he wouldn't answer the questions properly, and he was kind of tap dancing all over the place. And so at some point or another, she gave an interview to a journalist who and said the basic notion that she couldn't believe that a plane hit the Pentagon because she walked out of a hole with whatever the bomb, whatever went off there, created. I had that time as already part of the movement, I guess we would say, and she was put in contact with me, and we interviewed her. My friend Dennis Cunningham is a famous civil rights lawyer. He and I decided that we should do something about this if we could. And so we interviewed her, and we decided that a complaint should be filed, because she was injured as a result of this attack. And the first and most important thing about the attack was the fact that the Pentagon was hit. And in order for the Pentagon to have been hit, the first notion is that there must have been somebody on the inside turning all the defenses off. And you don't have to look very far to find out that there, in fact, was just that. And so we then learn about the activities of Dick Cheney at the time, Vice President of the United States. He was in the Presidential Emergency Operations Center that morning, and according to Norm Mineta, he was the only Democrat in the cabinet, and was the Secretary of Transportation. He was escorted down to the PIOC, if you will, that morning around 9:15 or 9:20, maybe a little later. And when he got there, Cheney was in charge and giving instructions and things like that. And as Mineta was watching what was going on, a gentleman, a military officer, put his head in the room and said, "Mr. Cheney, the plane is 50 miles out," and then walked out the door and came back in a little bit later and said, plane is 30 miles out, sir." And then came back in a minute or so later and said, "Sir, the plane is 10 miles out. Do the orders still stand?" And Cheney, according to Mineta, whipped his neck around and looked at the guy and said, "Of course they still stand. Have you heard anything to the contrary?" And minutes later, they got notice that the Pentagon was up in smoke. So that was the most important piece of testimony, and remains, in my opinion, the most important piece of testimony about 9/11, because there are only two choices about what those orders were. One is that the order was to stand down, in essence, to whatever defenses that we have to the Pentagon. We want that plane to be immune to them. And the second possibility is that the orders were to shoot down that plane. Well, we know that that plane was not shot down. And what happens in the United States military, at least on paper, is when there's something, there's an order that's not followed out, there's an inquiry, and there are boards of inquiry, and there are court-martials, things like that, that make people be held accountable for their failures. That's the best way to prevent them in the future. And so we know by the fact that all the people who were involved in this attack in the Pentagon were all promoted after this attack as opposed to discipline. We know that the order was not to shoot down the plane. The order was to stand down the defenses. So that's the most important piece of evidence that we have. And we have it against the person that we could actually take to court right now if we could. And that's what I tried to do in the lawsuit. We filed the lawsuit against Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and Richard Myers, who was at that point the acting joint chiefs of chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, And we filed a lawsuit to go on, and the United States Attorney for the Southern District of New York, which is where the lawsuit had to be filed, responded that the idea was ridiculous and that it should be the case should be dismissed. Well, when we got that papers, we filed a motion or responded to that motion saying this was could not be a frivolous lawsuit. It was based in fact, and how could what we say be frivolous when in fact it's true? So when we made our initial allegations about the Pentagon, we didn't include anything about New York. We were going to try to kind of sidle into the whole issue because the issue is so difficult. Generally, we thought the best thing to do is just focus on Virginia, what happened to the Pentagon and April Gallup first, and then we will amend our complaint later on with the matters of what took place in New York. And so we filed 60 pages of affidavits demonstrating what had happened in New York and everything else. Well, the case was ultimately dismissed. Judge Denny Chin decided that there was our allegations were the product of cynical delusion and fantasy, and didn't deal with any of the 60 pages of affidavits that we had filed. We then appealed to the Second Circuit, and they agreed with Denny Chin and, in fact, sanctioned us for filing a frivolous lawsuit and never dealt with any of the facts about Cheney that we kept in our put in our complaint. The dishonesty with which they dealt with the case is breathtaking, really, because the most important thing we said was that Cheney was giving orders about this element of the offense, this instrumentality of the crime, at the time of the crime and the place of the crime, and those facts were not even mentioned. We put them all in our complaint, but when the response came from the U.S. attorney and the response came from the district court and the response came from the Second Circuit, those facts were never mentioned. It is as if, I think I said in the complaint, one of the papers, someone was reviewing an indictment for a liquor store holdup, and they decided, and for some reason or another, it didn't mention the fact that they saw the defendant go into the store with a gun. They left that part out. It's just exactly the same thing to fail to mention Cheney under these circumstances. So that's where we are. That was 10 years ago, pretty close. And we had a publisher who said that she would publish the book that we were going to write. She told us to write a book, and we did, or I did. And then in 2014 or so, when it was all together and we were submitting it to the publisher decided that she wasn't going to do it, or the publisher decided they weren't going to do it. So I kind of put it away for 4 years, and then in 2018 got interested in it again, and then finished up working on it, a number of months ago, and published a daggone thing myself. So there it is for anybody to read who wants to know what I did. And it includes the latest stuff that I'm aware of, the most interesting piece of factual material. So it's an opportunity for people to just see one man's disaster played out before them.
I think the most accurate stuff is the stuff that people have to publish themselves, because if it honestly tells the truth, then, of course, corporate institutions like these publishing companies aren't going to want to touch it. I mean, I've been in bookstores a couple of times over the years, and besides your obvious fiction stuff, your history and your current events books are really just celebrities in the political world aggrandizing themselves now. You see a picture of them looking off distantly like heroes. Basically, a lot of times, too, it's a forerunner to a presidential campaign or something like that, but just absolute trash, not even worth looking at. So you got to go to the indies out there, the independent publishers, the independent filmmakers to get anything that is of any quality and of any factual basis, the people doing it because they care about the truth and are looking for some greater agenda. They know they're not going to make a ton of money off of it. So I commend you for doing that and taking that initiative and standing by your work, even if the publisher wouldn't stand by you, and also standing by the work that you did regarding April Gallup. I'm curious, just before we start talking about the meat and potatoes of the book, did you have any idea that it would go in this direction, or were you just completely surprised by the level of censure that you received as a result of bringing this case to the court?
Yeah, no, I think that's a very important, or at least it's important to me. And the answer is, we knew that we weren't going to win. But we simply did not know how we were going to lose. And what is absolutely clear is that we did not have any idea of the depth to which the four judges would go, shredding their oaths, lying, ignoring evidence, looking at the precedents that need to be applied and just forgetting about them. That we had no idea was going to take place. And we, we're lawyers, so we know a bunch of lawyers and judges and things like that. And we submitted our stuff to many people to kind of check it with us. And nobody suggested that you're looking at sanctions here if you say this, or they're just going to lie to this extent and that's how they'll take care of you. So that was a total surprise. We knew we were going to lose because we were up against the most powerful forces in the universe, but we just did not conceive of them going to the depths and the lengths that they did.
Absolutely ridiculous. Let's get into the book. It's called 9/11, The Awful Truth. It's available on Amazon. And in fact, folks, I'm going to link the Amazon page to the description under the show this week so you can find it there and buy it. But Bill, tell us a little bit more of what this book is about.
It's a memoir. What I did was I talked about my relationship to the case and the facts of 9/11, but the fact is that initially when it took place, I thought, at least when I got into it, I decided that this is a political problem. Lawsuits, I'm a criminal lawyer, I'm not a civil lawyer, so I had no business in civil court, I said this is a political problem. So I said. Why don't I run for Senate? This is where this should be. And so I wrote speeches and I put them on the internet. Had a website called VealTruth.com, which I put up there after I retired in 2006 from my public defending gig. And I thought, what we need to do is we need to get, people to read these books that I've read. And get the journalists, and to provoke, make sure, they understand people are watching. Just come on, deal with this thing. So I went, I went around to journalists and I wrote them. I wrote letters to countless people. And that's, they all, not all of the letters, but a sampling of them that are in the book. But then I would travel around and I, went to actual people's homes and to their businesses. And things like that. I managed to get a couple of in-person interviews with, for example, Walter Pincus of the Washington Post, who is the grandfather of investigative journalism in this country. And I had an hour and a half with him over oatmeal one morning in D.C. I had another interview with a guy named Philip Sheenan, who wrote a book called The Commission, that I think might have won a Pulitzer Prize, I'm not sure, about the 9/11 Commission, where I, you know, asked him about very concrete problems that he did not deal with in his book. It's interesting, those are two examples. Walter Pincus never, you know, the idea that the government could have been involved in this abysmal disaster here never occurred to him. It literally was not something that he could even think about. And when I talked to him more, he kind of said, oh, well, how about this for an explanation for that, you know, just off the top of his head. And he made a couple of valiant stabs, but it wasn't even close. So then when I left, you know, he'd done as much as he could do. He had no answers to any of the questions that I had. I sent him a kind of a brief, you know, 3 or 4 page letter saying, what about, could you address these particular issues one by one so that we could have something to discuss? And, you know, I never heard from him. Phil Sheehan, on the other hand, I walked into his room, into the Starbucks in DuPont Circle in Washington, and handed him Barton Gellman's book, The Angler, about Cheney. And showed him the pages where he talked about what happened that morning and when Cheney got to Piak. And Sheehan looked at that and read that and said, well, you know, that's simply not true. I said, I understand it's not true, but I want to know, you know, why didn't you talk about Mineta when you wrote your book? You know, Barton Gellman, actually, I called him up and I got him on the phone, which is amazing. Now you can't do that particularly. I got him on the phone and I said, listen, did you have a chance to, did you interview Mineta? And he said, I didn't get to it. I said, why not? He said, well, I had all these other records. I had no reason to believe that he wasn't, that they, these records weren't true. Well, I said, okay, fine. Then he was on deadline, so I couldn't talk to him anymore. He left out, and his account left out, and Cheney's account leaves out 33 minutes after the second tower is hit, where supposedly he's sitting in his office there waiting for the Secret Service to come in and drag him out of there. Now, that's simply not what happened. We know that because we know, you know, generally speaking, what goes on with the Secret Service. We know because I actually asked the Secret Service agent at the White House one day when I was there just for a garden tour. I said, how long would it have taken for Cheney to be out of his office within after the second tower hit? He said seconds. So I know that that's not true, and we know it's not true for all kinds of documents which have come to light since. I began writing the book, or since we did our case. Wonderful journalists have done FOIA requests and gotten all kinds of documents since, and we know that Cheney was in the PIOC at 9, by the time the Pentagon was hit anyway, by 9:30 or so, and we've got it from maybe 5 different sources, including, and the important one I think is mostly, is from Ashley Estes, who is the secretary to George Bush. And she tells a story to I think it was 60 Minutes 2 was interviewing her about the morning, and she gave this statement, which I got a copy of from the White House, which says, you know, I was sitting there and watching the television, and then I heard this banging in the hallway, and there goes the vice president out of the door. You know, and he was being dragged down the hall by the Secret Service agents, and that was right after the second tower hit. That's precisely what happened. And when Gellman wrote his book, he left out those 33 minutes and adopted some of the timeline that the vice president thought was okay for him. So anyway, when I handed that book to Phil Sheehan, he said, that's not true. But I said, well, why didn't you include in your account an interview with Mineta? And he said, you know, I don't know. I think, I can't remember now why I didn't go into it. He said, but I don't think, you know, Mineta was an old guy. You know, maybe it was the fog of war. He didn't understand things the way they were actually taking place. But he had no evidence for any of those things. And he said, you know, I've kind of moved on, and I haven't been thinking about this for a long time. He said, but importantly, he said, but if I miss this story, it's the biggest story. And it is, I can't remember the word that he actually used, but it suggested that he would have an abysmal view of his own performance if he missed the story, which he did.
Just for you, I mean, we're in our last few minutes here. I ask this question sometimes of guests, and I'm going to ask it of you because you have been personally affected by your work with 9/11 Truth, particularly in the April Gallup case. So I want to know, what keeps you going? What keeps you hopeful? What keeps you publishing books so many years after this, even though you've been personally affected? What keeps you in the game?
Yeah, there's sort of a general reaction that I have to what I consider to be the denial. When you put the facts as you and I know them before, you know, really good journalists, Matt Taibbi, for example, he and I have had email exchanges and things like that where he's accused me of wearing a tinfoil hat. But I respond with questions. And I say, well, what about this? What about this? What about this? And I get no response. And so the question then becomes, you know, to what extent is this denial? And to what extent are people lying to themselves? Or to what extent are they unable to sleep at night because of what they know they're doing by not bringing forth what they have? I don't know. It's a drive to get to people, you know, to have them have it put before them so that they have to say, no, that's not true, or I have no explanation for that. It's why we're never getting anywhere until we get two people who know what they're talking about in the room, one on either side of the question. I would love to have an opportunity to be on the radio with Matt Taibbi or somebody like that so that I ask them, well, what about, what do you say about this? What about this? What about this? So I published the book because I needed to get it off of my plate. It's been sitting there for so long, I wanted to get it done. But, you know, there's lots of things going on, and I've got, you know, I'm in contact with people who are investigating still. And so I wanted to include those matters in the book and give people an opportunity to see as much as I have seen. So that's why I keep going. I don't know. I'm not going to do anything beyond this, I don't think, at this point, even though if I were, you know, 60 years old instead of 72, I would file a lawsuit against Cheney today and Rumsfeld. I'd do it all again. And we wouldn't make the mistake that we made the first time with not including the New York allegations. All of that would have been in there. That's what we'd do if I were to do it today. And any judge would have an enormous problem if they had to deal with all of that stuff all in one complaint. And that's what we should have done. We made a tactical decision to not include the stuff in New York initially. And so they were able to cheat. In my opinion, it's totally cheating not to deal with it in the second response. But anyway, we wouldn't make that mistake second time if I was 60, but I'm not.
Well, God bless you for the work that you have done and setting the precedent and laying the groundwork for future activists, lawyers, and such. I think the story is not finished. I think that we're going to have justice on this issue at one point, and it is going to shake the world. And it's going to be because of people like you and people in the audience doing everything that they do in so many different ways and methods. But, yeah, it's coming. It's coming. We're going to shake the world up. Bill Veal, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for coming on 9/11 Free Fall today.
Thank you for having me, sir. Take care.
This program is on every Thursday night on No Lies Radio at 10 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Pacific, and every other Sunday night on BBS Radio at 8 o'clock Eastern, 5 o'clock Pacific. You can also keep track of the archives by going to 911freefall.com. This is Andy Steele. So have a great week. Good luck.
The views expressed on this show by guests and the host on issues outside of the 9/11 controlled demolition evidence are the opinions of those individuals alone and do not necessarily reflect those of our contestants in the New York 9/11 Truth.
Welcome to 9/11 Freefall. I'm the host, Andy Steele. Today we're joined by Ted Walter. Ted is the Director of Strategy and Development here at AE 9/11 Truth. He is the lead author of AE 9/11 Truth's 2015 publication. It's called Beyond Misinformation, What Science Says About the Destruction of World Trade Center Buildings 1, 2, and 7, and as well as our 2016 publication, World Trade Center Physics. Very handy guide there for someone trying to reach people in the academic community. And most recently, AE 9/11 Truth requests for correction to the NIST report on World Trade Center Building 7, which was submitted last April and is still pending. We got a new congressional outreach going on that we're going to be talking about. So, Ted, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Andy. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
So you're here to talk about our latest effort with Congress. Why don't you lead the way and lay it out for our audience?
Sure. For, I would say, pretty much since the beginning of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, the organization, along with its volunteers, supporters, and small staff, and particularly the architects and engineers, have been involved in reaching out to Congress, sending Congress materials, pushing for a new investigation. As many people will know, the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth petition actually is, you know, literally a petition to Congress calling for a new investigation into the destruction of the three towers on 9/11. So this is really what we're talking about here, is sort of just the latest stage in a long process that that's been going on for many years. As many people will know, but not everybody. A few years ago, we launched something called the Boppy McIlvain World Trade Center Investigation Act campaign, which was draft legislation that we drafted that would establish a select committee in either chamber of Congress to reinvestigate the destruction of the three World Trade Center towers. Boppy McIlvain is a 9/11 victim who was killed when he was entering the lobby of the North Tower. Evidence points to this even right before the first plane hit. There were explosions in the basement and in the lobby of the North Tower that his father and his family believes are what killed him. And his father, Bob, has been one of the most outspoken advocates for a new investigation and has worked for many years. And a lot of the activism that he's done has been with Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. So that legislation we named after his son, and we are still continuing to push it. You can go to our website and find the section of our website that says the Boppy McIlvain Act. We, given that we're sort of in a new, obviously there's a new administration, and there's a new Congress. Every 2 years, a new Congress convenes, and we're just now, you know, a month and a half into the new Congress. And so typically around this time, which we did 2 years ago again, is where we revitalize or focus on getting the message to the new Congress. Like, there's many new members now. Right now, at the beginning of the session is the time to be reaching out to them and looking at this as, okay, we've got 2 years to like try to get something done with this particular Congress. And I think we're seeing really on both sides of the aisle more sort of anti-establishment sentiment than we've ever seen before. You know, whether you're conservative leaning or liberal or progressive or libertarian or what have you, you know, there's more frustration with the establishment, with the status quo than ever before. And I think that combined with the fact that we're coming up on the 20th anniversary of 9/11, that's just, you know, 6 or 7 months away, I think we really do have a fairly unique window right now in which the outreach that we do to Congress, as unlikely as it may seem, given what we've seen over the last, you know, 15 years, where a real concerted effort, where we're involving lots of people in the grassroots, could make a difference, could find that one or two members of Congress who are really willing to champion the issue this year as the 20th anniversary rolls around. And beyond that, even if those one or two don't surface, or maybe it's more than one or two, but it's really important that this message is properly delivered to all these members of Congress, because change happens a little bit. Well, change can seem to be happening slowly, and then all of a sudden it just sneaks up on you and explodes. If you've got hundreds of members of Congress who've been properly informed with the materials that we're producing and getting to them and involving our supporters and getting to them, they're less likely to make negative statements about 9/11 Truth, which that alone helps us. But, you know, if things just start to break, just start to turn in the right direction,
And you've got members of Congress who've been seeing this stuff sent to them. Their staffs have been receiving materials, receiving emails, phone calls, requests for meetings, et cetera. The slippery slope to suddenly many members of Congress taking the issue seriously and speaking out and something happening can go a lot faster as soon as things start to turn in our favor. And I would say, like, just in general, we're really optimistic about what this year has in store, because in large part because of the 20th anniversary. And so we think that it is really worth, for all of our supporters out there, for everybody that cares about 9/11, like, this is a year that is really worth doing everything that you can. Whatever comes to mind, whether it's the stuff that we send out, this is the year to really give it all, because good things could happen this year in particular. So as far as the particular strategies that we're doing, the way that we're reaching out to Congress, we just this week now we are launching an effort to where we're asking supporters to donate $20, and we will send you 3 copies of the DVD of the new documentary 7, which was released in December by Dylan Avery. And it's about the 4-year computer modeling study at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, led by Professor Leroy Halsey, which has basically completely definitively shown that fires could not have destroyed Building 7, and has really helped highlight the ways in which the NIST report is false and fraudulent, frankly, although that language is obviously not used in the UAF report. So we want to get this DVD into the hands of every member of Congress, all 535 or 541, if you include the non-voting delegates. If we can get several hundred of our supporters sending these DVDs to Congress, we will reach the large majority of them. If we can get a few thousand supporters, we will reach pretty much every member of Congress. So really urging people to spend what is, you know, for most people, a pretty manageable amount of money, $20, receive 3 DVDs, and we give you all the materials that you need, the 3 envelopes and a pre-written letter. So all you need to do is sign it, put the letter in the envelope, put the DVD in the envelope, bring it to the post office, another $10 spent, and bam, you've contacted your 3 members of Congress and given them this DVD. And I think a DVD in the mail to Congress is going to stand out a lot more than a letter. And it's a very nicely designed DVD, I must say. So we're gonna really get people's attention with the DVD. Some of them will watch it, some of them won't. But it's also about due diligence. And this is something that we're really emphasizing, is we want to at least make it so that things start to turn in our favor and people in Congress start getting a little uncomfortable about the fact that they haven't done anything about 9/11. We have the paper trail to show that they were informed about it and they chose to do nothing, if indeed that's what happens, which is likely to happen with most members of Congress. They probably won't do anything right away. But it's really important that we do the due diligence, that we create the paper trail that shows these people were informed about it and they chose to do nothing. So that's what's happening right now this week. $20, receive 3 DVDs, put them in the mail to each of your members of Congress, and we'll hit most of Congress with this DVD. Imagine being able to say, for all of us who've dedicated themselves to this cause and to helping architects and engineers find the truth, that almost all of Congress has received the DVD 7. That in itself is a good step forward.
Right on. I love doing outreach to Congress, even the ones that don't want to hear this message. In some ways, it's a little bit more fun to try to get this information to them. As Ted said, it puts them on record that at this critical moment in the history of our nation, these people did not stand with the truth. They did not stand up for scientific integrity. They decided to go on business as usual. And we can see now the results of that. As Ted mentioned before, on both sides of the political aisle, there's a very anti-establishment sentiment. This is all good for the 9/11 truth movement, because as people get mad about other things, we can point back to World Trade Center 7, to the fall of the Twin Towers. We can say, hey, look, this information that you disregarded earlier, look at it again, and people are more open to this now. Just as I predicted years ago, I knew that things were going to happen. I just had a feeling that things were going to happen to make people more open to this. And they're going to look back and they're going to remember their friends who were talking about 9/11 truth all those years. And I can see it even in my own life. Everybody's turning to me now to tell them what's going to happen next, because I was talking about 9/11 all this time. And, you know, certain other things have made them wake up to the realities of our world. And they're realizing that I'm not as easy to dismiss as I once was. And I imagine that's happening for people out in the audience as well. And this is important to do because we got to keep the pressure on. I say this on the webinars every single week, is that members of Congress don't do anything they would rather not do unless they hear from a lot of constituents, unless they're put on the spot. And activism is not just going there and having one meeting and sending one letter. It's the continuous work. It's the due diligence that Ted is talking about. And this is so important to us that we are going to give you the three DVDs for just $20. I mean, it's listed for $15 on the online store just for your own personal viewing, but we're going to give you three of them with the expectation that you're going to go and do this work, send it to your member of Congress, and every little bit helps. Look, you don't have to be particularly talented in this world. You don't have to be particularly some kind of high-level, genius-level intelligence to get things done. All you got to do is show up and do the work. And maybe you make a mistake the first time. You learn from it, and then you get more talented, and you get more intelligent about the thing that you're doing, the action that you're doing as you go. But the key is just showing up and doing it. Those are the people that always succeed, and collectively we can succeed because we've already got our foot in the door. Everybody knows about this issue. To some extent, everybody knows that there's questions surrounding September 11th. I mean, you can't even mention Building 7 without people automatically thinking about the question of how it came down. That's what this building is notorious for. So you got to go ahead and participate in things like this when they come up. And we've made it so easy for you. We're going to send you the three DVDs. We've already written a letter for you. So you just got to stick it in the mail and send it in. And it's with all of us doing this collective work that we're going to achieve justice. It's no one action. It's the culmination of many actions. And we've seen the results of that before when we did that with C-SPAN. That's just one effort. That was a lot of people all over this country calling into that show, and it resulted in Richard being on there and being the number one interview. And that's just a tiny thing. Think about what we can accomplish if we move it on into Congress. And the great thing about what's going on right now is they still have phone meetings. We're going to be talking about that in just a minute. Ted, you mentioned about sending them the physical copy, how that will stand out. Why is it important that they actually get a physical copy of the DVD as opposed to us just sending a link to an MP4 version that we're streaming?
Yeah, well, I actually think that they're more likely to watch it when they get the DVD. I think that they're people in Congress, they get a lot of emails. They're not going to be keen to just click on a link and go spend time on a computer watching this 45-minute film, but if you put a DVD in their hands, even though people don't watch DVDs as much these days, I think I myself, having been in these offices, having meetings with people in Congress, there tend to be TVs in the offices and there tend to be DVD players there. And so I think it's probable that many of these people will actually watch the DVD, much more probable than if we were sending a link to where they could pay to watch it on Amazon or on Google Play or whatever. And yeah, it's as I said before, as you said, it's an attention grabber. It's a very nicely designed DVD. It just presents the issue very, very professionally, very slickly, and in a way that it looks like it's going to be entertaining to watch. So I think that's really important. And we've spoken to the cost of this. We're basically doing it at cost. We're offering the DVDs so that there's like zero net revenue being made here. We wanted to make it as easy as possible for people to participate. It's about $30 to A, $20 to donate to get the three DVDs and the packages, and then $10 that you're going to have to pay when you walk down to the post office and put these in the mail, you know, roughly $3, $3.50 per package to each member of Congress. So, yeah, there's a letter in there as well that's optional. We provided a letter. If you want to write your own letter, totally understandable. We have a letter that's very carefully worded that we think a lot of our supporters are going to feel good putting their name on. And it also does something really important, which is inform the member of Congress about the request for correction that we have pending with NIST right now that we and 10 9/11 family members submitted to NIST last April, which Andy mentioned at the beginning of the show. That along with the DVD and the study, it's such an effective way to gain credibility in the eyes of these members of Congress is to show that we have this request for correction that's pending, this administrative process that we're using to try to force NIST to reverse its conclusion, abandon its original report, and come clean that the building was brought down by controlled demolition. So really, that's the other really important thing that you would be participating in is not only giving them the DVD and for educating them about the study, but about the request for correction, which when they see that, it's going to, that will be an eye opener for them as well.
Right. And the thing is, members of Congress are no different than any other human being. They're susceptible to marketing just like you and I are. And if you actually get something in the mail that you can hold, you can see the cover, it's going to catch your attention more than just an email. I mean, good God, my inbox is like Penn Station. I get so many emails a day. It's easy to miss things. I can't imagine what it's like for a U.S. congressman's office. And, of course, a lot of staffers intercept those emails, and you get some very generic responses sometimes if they're just overall well-wishing emails from constituents. So if something actually comes through the door and it's got nice pictures on it and a nice description in the background, it's more interesting. It's more eye-catching. It's going to get their attention. That's why we got to do these kinds of things, and we got to mail it in because it's very hard to get access to physically to Congress right now. However, we can call them on the phone. We can have phone meetings, and we've done this before, and this is part of the due diligence follow-up that Ted was talking about, and it never ends. It's never something that we stop doing. We're always willing to do these phone meetings with members of Congress, but we're going to have a big push on Congress this year, focusing on outreach to them, because that is the route that it has to go through in order to get justice in the end. That's the whole petition at 1811 Truth is about. So we're going to remind our audience on how to do these phone meetings, which I'm going to be a large part of helping to coordinate, as I have been in the past. Ted, can you talk about that part?
Yeah, well, you are the expert on the phone meetings more than I am, but I, you know, all the work you did last year and in previous years, but I think that, you know, keep an eye out for in the next couple of months, email action alerts asking you to request a meeting with your member of Congress, typically U.S. representative in the House of Representatives. And since COVID started, it's become a lot more common to just have these meetings with constituents over the phone, which is what we did last spring. We had a lot of meetings with the staff of these members of Congress. And the constituent would come on the call with us, and Andy would be there with a couple other of our experts. Richard Gage would usually be on the call, maybe Roland Engel, a civil engineer who's on our board of directors, and make the case to the staff. And, you know, they're very polite, usually very receptive, and we kind of show them the collapse of Building 7, or I should say the destruction of Building 7, on the video, on their own computer. They could be watching it while we are talking about it with them. It's always an eye-opener for the people that see it. They often just agree, yeah, that looks like a controlled demolition. And they move the issue forward to their higher-ups and to the member of Congress. So, again, like the DVD, it's another way of really getting the message there much louder than just sending an email, making a phone call. And, you know, you get to participate with us. It's also easy. I mean, it doesn't involve much time. Usually these meetings are like 15 minutes, 30 minutes at most. And but it can make a big difference. And this is how we find those few members of Congress who would be willing to champion the issue, especially as the 20th anniversary rolls around.
Right. And it's a great first step for being a local leader as well, because we're going to need you to be out there. And there's a lot of people who settle for just getting the meeting and then, you know, the person heard my case, and that's it. But what it really takes is being a constant presence, getting them to learn your name, know who you are, know exactly what you are about, doing the follow-up, and letting them know that you are out there and informing others in your community, first about this issue and about your congressman or congresswoman's stance on it or how they have responded or no response. And that's an important thing, too, because there's some people, not many, most of them got meetings in the last time that we did this or that we made a big push for this. But there's some people who didn't. But I'll tell you what, making that effort and doing everything you can to get that meeting and then being either ignored or turned down is still important, because then you can make a note of it. And then there's other things that you can do. Maybe that member of Congress comes up for re-election and you reach out to the person's opponent and say, hey, this congressman didn't respond, or this person ignored me or said this when I talked about this issue, but I know 9/11 family members who are supportive of it, and I find that very disturbing, and I will support you if are willing to at least listen to the evidence and have a meeting when you come into office. If they say yes, you can hold them to account on that. Wait a few months and make another request. You have to be a constant lobby for this issue in your area and not just give up just because you had a meeting with them one time or because your congressman ignored you. Again, it's the constant action that results in success in the end. And then actually doing the meeting, I mean, for us it's fun, and we're so coordinated and calculated with this now, and we've got a whole setup here, a whole meeting setup that we do, and we do show them the video of World Trade Center 7, and a lot of times, as Ted said, they said that it looks just like a controlled demolition. So we are informing staffers, and here's the thing too, those staffers, they may be under the thumb of their member of Congress and that person's agenda, but at some point those staffers become the new members of Congress. A lot of them run later on, and if they're awake to this, then who knows what kind of influence you may have in the future. Even if it isn't about 9/11, maybe it's some legislation that gets brought up that you would disagree with, knowing what you know about 9/11, and maybe they will too, even if they don't state it. I mean, our work has a three-dimensional effect, and it affects so many other things. So the only way that you lose in participating in something like this is if you don't participate. It's all winning. It's all good returns, no matter what you do. You can hold them to account. And we need you to be that local leader out there taking advantage of this opportunity. I mean, we're here doing what we do, and we can advise you and tell you, you know, what we think ought to be done next, but we need you out there doing the groundwork and being that voice in your district who is willing to bring this issue to your congressman or bring it to their opponent next time they come up for re-election, but letting them know it's not going away. Now, something I want to quickly address, and I got my own opinion, but I like to let Ted talk first here because I might be inclined to ramble. A segment of our listening audience doesn't think much of our government institutions anymore for obvious reasons, and they'll say, oh, what's the purpose of reaching out to Congress? We know what they're like. Why is this so important in your view, Ted?
Well, I think it's important to try every conceivable avenue that could lead to getting a new investigation, getting a breakthrough, or that could even just a small step in the right direction. And we are trying all of those avenues here at 89 Love the Truth, whether it's the inquest that we're helping the family of Jeff Campbell, the 9/11 victim from the UK, helping them get a new inquest into the death of their son, or the request for correction that I mentioned before, the films that we put out. Congress is another avenue. You find a member of Congress who is willing to champion this issue, and I think that the political climate all the time is getting better and better for it. That would be a big step forward. That could start a tidal wave eventually if more members of Congress, they have a platform, and you know, and I'm convinced that many of them already know the truth, and they're not just, you know, corrupt people who are okay with it. It's just they're maybe looking for the right opportunity. So it's about letting them know that we exist. The change is not going to happen if you don't try. And at 89 Love the Truth, we're not nihilists. We believe that it's possible to change the world. You see the world changing all the time because people work hard and people believe in things. We have chosen against the alternative of doing nothing. That's why we're here. And you have to recognize that it's an uphill battle. You're not going to see results tomorrow necessarily, but nothing happens if you don't try. And this is a totally legitimate, realistic avenue. And when things start falling, when things start turning, the dominoes start falling, people in Congress will want to get on the right side of history. And so it's about pushing them, nudging them so that they see that, yeah, that is the truth. Oh, here's an opportunity for me to actually do something. So that's how I see it. What do you think, Andy?
Yeah, a ditto on all of that. I mean, something we have to remember is that a lot of the people in Congress weren't necessarily there on September 11th, so it's not their cover-up until you bring the information to them. So you either make them involved in the cover-up or you open their eyes and start getting them involved in bringing the truth to light. So there's always hope. Congress is always changing, and as we said already, that there's an anti-establishment fervor going on both sides of the political aisle right now. I think the society is becoming more susceptible to recognizing certain truths, like what really happened on September 11th. Something you got to remember too. I mean, nothing has ever been solved overnight. That's kind of how the system works. I mean, abolition of slavery. It wasn't that we just elected some president and he ended slavery overnight. I mean, that took many decades of people making great sacrifices and really sticking their neck out and doing important work to change attitudes in this country to the point where it could result in legislation and big change from what people were used to. So, I mean, if those people can do it, we can do it. We're not even asking you to do some of the things that those people did for that issue. All you got to do is, in this particular case, is buy some DVDs and stick them in the mail. Set up a phone meeting. Show up and tell the congressman why you think this is an important issue, and let Richard make the case for why the towers were brought down with explosives. Just participate in the process. It's really easy. Ted, we are out of time. Thank you so much for all the work you do right here. We work together, and I see what Ted does, and I see what everybody does here at AE911 Truth. A lot of great people working here, either up front or behind the scenes, to keep this issue alive and bring us to justice in the end. And, of course, Ted is a big part of that. So thank you, and thank you for coming on 911 Freefall today.
Thank you, Andy. Thank you for everything that you do.
This program is on every Thursday night on No Lies Radio at 10 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Pacific, and every other Sunday night on BBS Radio at 8 o'clock Eastern, 5 o'clock Pacific. You can also keep track of the archives by going to 911freefall.com. This is Andy Steele. So have a great week. Good luck.